Hello and welcome to Science World. NASA is preparing a new mission that will allow scientists to better study the sun. Suzanne Presto will have the story. Did you know that there's a team of U.S. paleontologists that have something in common with classic rock? We'll learn that something involves the fossil remains of a gigantic ancient creature. We'll have another question sure to tease your brain on our Science World Quick Quiz. And a researcher from Oxford University will tell us not so fast on those projections that suggest extreme global warming is right around the corner. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. NASA is preparing a new mission to better study the sun. Suzanne Presto tells us more about the Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, or IRIS, which will observe the way solar materials gather energy and heats up as it moves through the sun's lower atmosphere.
The upper layer of the sun's atmosphere, known as the corona, is thousands of times hotter than the sun's surface. Scientists want to figure out how that happens, so they are preparing a mission to study the sun's so-called interface region, the area between the sun's photosphere and its corona. Energy and plasma that flow through the interface region have an impact on us here on Earth. That region is the source of the sun's ultraviolet emission, which has an effect on our planet's climate, as well as the near-Earth space environment. Energy that seeps through the interface region drives solar wind. That's where NASA's Interface Region Imaging Spectrograph, or IRIS, mission comes into play. IRIS is a small satellite with the ability to perform complex solar observations. Alan Teitel is the IRIS principal investigator, based at Lockheed Martin's Advanced Technology Center in California.
What we want to discover is what the basic physical processes are that transfer energy and material from the surface of the sun out to the outer atmosphere, to the corona. And remember, the corona extends throughout the heliosphere. We live in the sun's outer atmosphere.
IRIS will provide high-resolution images that even will show individual structures of energy as they rapidly stretch away from the sun. The U.S. Space Agency says IRIS images will be 3 to 4 times as detailed as those from NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory. IRIS will also provide spectra, data that reveals information about multiple wavelengths of light at once. NASA says IRIS will observe a range of temperatures from about 5,000 to 65,000 degrees Celsius and up to about 10 million degrees Celsius during solar flares. But principal investigator Alan Teitel notes IRIS will not be observing the sun from up close.
IRIS flies around the Earth, so it only gets about 600 kilometers closer to the sun than here we are on Earth, and that's about 92 million miles away. So it's really not very much closer to the sun.
The $181 million mission is set to last 2 years, but scientists say the Solar Explorer could function much longer. IRIS is set to launch aboard a Pegasus XL rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California on June 26th. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
It's National Fishing and Boating Week here in the U.S., an annual celebration that not only encourages Americans to get out and enjoy the nation's rivers and streams, but one that offers an opportunity to create new stewards to help protect natural waterways. Roseanne Skirbel has more.
On this day, several hundred Washington schoolchildren go to class on the Anacostia River. They're greeted on a pier not far from the U.S. Capitol by U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell.
How many of you have ever been out on the Anacostia River before? Wow, you're regulars. Okay, well, this is my first time, so you're going to have to show me the ropes, okay?
The children take Jewel up on her offer and fan out across the pier, just steps from Washington's baseball stadium. While many have gone to a baseball game, fewer have boated or fished on the river. Some don life jackets for a boat ride with Jewel. Some model boats out of aluminum foil, talk to naturalists, or fish off the dock.
Like that, see in between your fingers?
A lot of catfish are up there, bottom fishing, so you want to get it close to the bottom.
catfish are bottom feeders waiting for worms. While it's fun to fish, these kids won't be taking their catch home. That's because the Anacostia is among the nation's most polluted waterways. A recent study finds that more than half of all bottom feeders have liver tumors. Another quarter have visible lesions. Dennis Chestnut grew up on the river. Now he runs Groundwork Anacostia River, D.C. The group links community development to the health of the waterway. He says the children here are learning valuable lessons.
It's an opportunity for these kids to see this trash. I'm quite sure that some will begin asking questions, which is another thing. Why is this trash here?
On another day, we meet Chestnut at Bladensburg Park, a less polluted stretch of the Anacostia, some 5 kilometers away. Lee Kane, our river guide, is with the Anacostia Watershed Society. He says silt from development clogged the waterway, and as the population grew, so did pollution.
And there's over a million people that live in this little tiny watershed. It's about 176 square miles. And because there's so many people, there's so much impact.
Kane docks at Kenilworth Park, a former landfill that's now a grassy field. We follow Kane and Dennis Chestnut down a steep hill to a stream that feeds the Anacostia. Chestnut's group manages a litter trap in the stream. Kane goes knee deep into the muck to help clean it up.
So 80% of the trash in the Anacostia is bottles,
yes, styrofoam, or plastic bags.
Man, if you had a bottle, people would be paying you to come down here and clean this up.
Yep, you're right. You're right.
Kane loads trash bags with the bottles and throws balls lodged in the trap to Chestnut, who's standing on the bank talking to 18-year-old Trayvon Brocks and 19-year-old Anthony Smith. They've come prospecting for jobs.
One of the things that this opportunity provides to guys like you who are young guys, have a whole lot of work time in front of you, this is a good, honest work. Does a great service, and you can, you can earn income.
Brocks and Smith live nearby, but grew up largely ignoring the river. They're shocked by what they see.
This is my first time, like, really being up close, and that's a sticky situation down there.
To be honest, I never even knew it was a park back here. Never even knew about the river or anything, so.
We all need to come together, stand up, and keep our environment clean, because that's a safety hazard.
20,000 tons of trash are thrown into the Anacostia every year. It turns into a toxic brew, including sewage overflows and runoff from driveways, streets, and sidewalks. Chestnut says the litter traps he manages barely make a dent in the pollution. But he adds what they can do is get people like Brocks and Smith to care enough to do something about it.
The goal is to get the river to the point where it's fishable and swimmable. What it's going to take is getting everyone engaged at whatever level they can become engaged, from the youngest to the oldest, to do their part.
The health of the Anacostia and rivers like it around the country and around the world depend on that commitment. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, on the Anacostia River in Bladensburg, Maryland.
We just heard about the new mission NASA is planning to help scientists learn more about the sun. So today we want to know from the following, what is the name of the science used by some scientists and by NASA that involves study of the sun and the effects it has on Earth and the rest of the solar system? Is it A, heliophysics, B, cosmochemistry, or C, astronautics? Do you think you have the right answer? We'll fill you in with the correct answer in just a little bit. This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science. NASA has announced a new contest to inspire a new generation to become involved with the future of space exploration. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
The U.S. Space Agency and the LEGO Group, creator of the popular building brick and model construction kits, have teamed up for a unique new contest called NASA's Missions imagine, and build. The competition will give young people the opportunity to share their vision of what they see as the future of space exploration. Contest entrants will use Lego bricks to build and create models of future NASA missions and spacecraft. Debbie Rivera, acting director of NASA's Public Outreach Division, tells us who can enter.
Yes, it is international in scope, and any one contest is for ages 13 and older, and the other one is for ages 16 and older.
Rivera says that those who'd like to enter this contest can do so online.
You can go to rebrick.lego.com, and all the information on the contest rules and entry forms, what have you, will be right there.
So once entered, Rivera tells us what a participant needs to do to win.
Inventing our future in flight, that's the one that we are looking for people to think about, an aircraft of the future that is actually based on something real, what NASA's working on right now. And they need to build it using Lego bricks.
Then, entrants will take pictures of their model and load them up to any photo-sharing website, such as Flickr.com. The other project category in the contest, called Imagine Our Future Beyond Earth, encourages participants to journey into space and beyond by creating one of NASA's future missions with Legos. Although they can be as creative as they wish, the entry models should reflect one of the future missions NASA is already planning through the 2030s, which are listed on NASA's website, nasa.gov/missions/future. To help design their vision of future spaceflight, participants will be able to use the Lego Digital Designer computer program that can also be found online at the redbrick.lego.com website. And of course, what's a challenging contest without prizes? Rivera tells us what the winners will receive.
There will be prizes for the winners, one of which is going to be a Lego building kit that will be autographed by one of the Lego designers. For one of the contests, there will be an actual trophy that is built out of Lego bricks. And for winners in both contests, there will be NASA commemorative material.
Again, if you'd like details and further information on NASA's Missions Imagine and Build competition, you can find them online at redbrick.lego.com. If you or your children want to enter, Rivera reminds us that the deadline for the contest will be July 31st at 12:59 Universal Time. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
The World Health Organization says the number of overweight and obese children in the developing world is climbing at an alarming rate, and countries need to do more to deal with the associated health risks. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau.
The World Health Organization says that an estimated 43 million children worldwide under the age of 5 were overweight or obese in 2011. 3/4 of these children live in low- and middle-income countries, many on the African continent. The terms overweight and obese refer to calculations of body mass index, what doctors call BMI. They use people's height, weight, and age to assess their amount of body fat, and then categorize them as underweight, normal, overweight, or obese. The WHO says being overweight or obese can lead to serious long-term health problems, like diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. The director of the WHO's Department of Nutrition for Health and Development, Francesco Branca, says there are a number of reasons why people in the developing world are packing on the pounds.
Food system is changing, and people are consuming more and more food, which is manufactured, and often the manufactured food has a high content of sugar, fat, and salt. So this is leading to overconsumption of food. Of course, this is also part of an overall change in lifestyle with increased urbanization and decreased physical activity as part of less physical labor, more motorized transport. So there are several components.
Experts say that not getting enough food or the right kinds of food remain a top concern in most of these countries, particularly for children. Branca says successful policy initiatives, such as urging exclusive breastfeeding during the first 6 months of life and the distribution of vitamin and nutrient supplements, have helped to reduce rates of child malnutrition and stunting in recent years. Now, he said, countries need to get proactive on childhood obesity.
There is a progress in the understanding of the problem, but now we also need to be very clear of what the policy gaps are and what the effective actions are. It's about an adequate control of also the marketing of food to children and about dialogue with the producers to manufacture food which has the adequate quality but also a reduced content of sugar, fat and salt, and actions on how to shape the availability of this food.
Branca said stopping the explosion of overweight or obese children isn't going to be easy. Even developed countries, like the United States and the United Kingdom, haven't been able to make much of a dent in their numbers. The current goal set by the WHO's World Health Assembly is to at least keep the percentage of overweight children from going up any further between now and 2025. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Paleontologist Jason Head from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln must be a huge fan of the legendary 1960s rock band, The Doors. Head and his team recently found fossils of a giant ancient lizard that once roamed the hot tropical forests of Southeast Asia and named the creature to honor the band's late lead singer, Jim Morrison. Head calls the creature Barbaturex morrisoni, meaning Lizard King, which also happens to be one of Morrison's popular nicknames, taken from the lyrics of a song The Doors singer once wrote. The king lizard that Head and his team found would have been almost 2 meters long, weighed a little over 27 kilograms, and competed with mammals for food and other resources some 40 million years ago. Head and his team found the fossils of the giant lizard in Myanmar and released a paper outlining the discovery this past week in the scientific journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. The study says that the remains of the large ancient lizard will provide new and important clues on the evolution of plant-eating reptiles and their relationship to global climate and competition with mammals. An analysis of the fossil also finds that it is one of the biggest known lizards ever to have lived on land. Head did confess that he listened to the music of The Doors quite a bit during the research and said that since some of the band's musical imagery includes reptiles and ancient places and that Jim Morrison was, of course, known as the Lizard King, it all kind of came together.
I'm the Lizard King. I can do anything.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today we wanted to know, from the following, what is the name of the science used by some scientists and NASA that involves study of the sun and the effect it has on Earth and the rest of the solar system? Is it A, heliophysics, B, cosmochemistry, or C, astronautics? The answer is A, heliophysics. Coined in 1981, heliophysics is the word used by NASA and some scientists to indicate study of our entire sun, from its core to its outer atmosphere, called the corona, as well as the effects it has on Earth and the rest of our solar system. It comes from the French word héliophysique, which is used to provide a distinction from physique solaire or solar physics, which refer to the study of the outer layers of the sun. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Over the years, we've heard a number of reports that indicated that unless we stop or seriously slow down our output of greenhouse gas emissions, we face some very serious climate and environmental consequences, with some of the findings predicting near apocalyptic ramifications. While long-term global warming is expected to be consistent with established and conventional estimates, a new study from Oxford University says that there's been a warming pause over the past decade, and that at least for the next 50 to 100 years, those extreme projections are looking less likely to occur. Dr. Alexander Otto from Oxford's Environmental Change Institute led the investigative team, and he joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about its research and findings. What did your team's research find?
We used the latest data available, especially including temperature data on the last decade, which has been reported to have a decreased rate of warming. So there is this warming pause that we see in the temperature record. And then, of course, the question is, does this now mean that climate change isn't happening or isn't happening as strongly as we thought before? And so we were following up on that question, and we find two very interesting insights. The first insight is that if we look at the very long-term response of the climate system to our emissions, which we call climate change, a very specific term, then we find that the estimates that we come up with are actually relatively consistent with former estimates. So I would summarize that as, in the very long term, we are still looking at severe climate change if we don't change our emission behavior. But the second and more interesting result is that another characteristic of the climate system, which is the shorter-term response, it's called the transient climate response, there we find that we actually have a slight adjustment downwards, not just in the expected value, the best guess, but also in the range of uncertainty, we have a slight adjustment downward. So what that means is we are essentially looking at the same long-term warming, but maybe a bit slower than we thought. A calculation example for that, if we managed to just double the concentration, then we would look at the consequences that we would have expected to happen by 2050, middle of the century, to happen just 10 or 15 years later. I wouldn't say that would justify saying that climate change isn't happening, but it shows that we still have quite some uncertainty about how strong it might actually react to our emissions, and it tells us something that we are not as certain about the timescale at which it might happen is still changing.
Dr. Otto, I'm quite curious about this thing that you call global warming pause. What is it?
What we are doing is we just look literally out of the window. We look at surface temperatures. That's the temperature taken at 2 meters above ground. And then, of course, we combine all these temperature measurements and we add satellite data and other data. And we still talk about global mean temperature, which means just taking the average of all the measurements. And then we look how this changes over time. And we've seen quite an interesting and dramatic increase over the last 40 years, I should say, with the 80s and 90s having the highest rates of increase of temperature. But from the very warm year 1998 onwards, there has been a lower rate of increase. It hasn't actually stopped. We still are seeing a very slight increase in temperature since 1998 and through the 2000s, but it has certainly been less rapid than in the decade before. And this has then been phrased by many people, warming pause, and this then has, of course, been used in discussions around whether or not climate change is happening or not as an argument against climate change happening. Whereas on the scientific side, we would actually expect single decades to jump around a bit, because we don't just have the long-term climate signal, the climate change signal, as response to greenhouse gas emissions and rising concentration levels, but we've got noise in the system. We have what we call decadal climate variability. So it can well be that one specific decade is a bit colder than the long-term trend would indicate, but then the next decade might work as the 90s were, really, really strong increase. So this is kind of the context for how we measure global warming and how it has paused over the last 10 years.
Speaking about the warming pause, especially since greenhouse gases and industrial output has continued to rise steadily over the years, why all of a sudden a pause in the global warming?
Our particular study has looked at, given that there was a pause, what does it mean for the future projections? But there has been other recent work that actually looked at what's the reason for that. So we are saying that the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the rising concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere captures more sunlight or more energy. And then the question, of course, is where has this energy gone? And one explanation that, among others, but the major explanation is that it was the upper oceans that have actually taken up more energy than before, and therefore it hasn't gone into increasing the temperature so much, but it was the upper part of the ocean that has taken up this heat over the 2000s.
That was Dr. Alexander Otto from the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University in the United Kingdom. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.